Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Times-Picayune and the city of New Orleans, once again in a storm, it's more than just a newspaper. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 29th of August. Good to have you with us. And listen, if you want to know what's going on down in New Orleans up to the minute, you could go to CNN, I guess, but you can only watch so many reporters standing in a hurricane before it gets stale, I'd say. Or you could do what I'm doing here in the studio right now. Pull up the website of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. NOLA.com is the address. And see not just what reporters are telling you, 500,000 people out of power, or the governor talking about intentionally breaching some levees, but you can also see what residents of New Orleans are experiencing. NOLA.com has become kind of a public repository for up-to-the-minute information about the storm. Tweets and pictures, all kinds of stuff. James O'Byrne is the director of content for NOLA.com. Mr. O'Byrne, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
It's kind of interesting that in the middle of the chaos that must be New Orleans today, people actually have the time to pick out their phone or take out their iPad or whatever it is and take a picture and have the presence of mind to send it along.
Well, one of the things that happened in Katrina is that we became one of the most smartphone intensive cities in America, because a lot of people didn't even replace their landlines after the storm. Mm. So everyone, we saw last night the highest activity on the site was actually after 9 o'clock, when we saw a huge burst in social media activity. That's when the weather got really bad, and that's when the power started going out. So that's when people were participating in these conversations, and we saw that activity continue all through the night with very little let up, actually. There's a little bit of lag between 3 and 5 a.m., but after that, everybody back at it.
Hmm. On your Twitter feed, through the paper and what you're seeing there, what are you seeing people looking for? Are they looking for assistance? Are they looking for food? Are they looking for moral support, I guess, maybe, huh?
I think they're partly looking for information, and partly they're intensely interested in sharing information. The social media space, the instinct is to share. Here's what's happening to me, or here's what's happening in my neighborhood. And because smartphones have become so powerful, we see video, we see photographs, and we see texts and tweets that just tell us in real time, as conditions change, what's going on around the city.
What happens, though, Mr. O'Byrne, if the power's out in New Orleans for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 days? I mean, that could be, right?
Could be, yes. As soon as the weather is calm enough to actually deliver papers, we will print wherever we need to print and disseminate those papers to our readers.
And what does it do then to the social media part of this equation, right, to the online part of the equation?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think, though, what happened is people got really resilient after Katrina, and most people have power inverters for their cars so they can charge their cell phones. And as long as they have their cell phones, and as long as they have a way to charge those cell phones, as long as they have gasoline, then we'll figure out a way to communicate with each other through social media.
Yeah. This paper, actually not the paper, right? The organization that is the Times-Picayune was, if you ask people who were there, sort of the lifeline. It was kind of the soul of New Orleans in Katrina. Do you feel the same way about that this time?
I certainly do. I mean, I think it's important to remember that in the most critical hours, probably in the city's history, we didn't have a printed paper. But what we did have was great journalists doing great journalism. And I think that you don't need newsprint to do great journalism. And in times of hurricanes and crisis like this, where power is limited, transportation is difficult, the digital space is even more vital and has become the way that people find out information. And I think going into the future, that will not change.
Yeah. James O'Byrne, he runs the website for the Times-Picayune down in New Orleans. It's NOLA.com if you want to check it out. Mr. O'Byrne, thanks so much for your time.
It's my pleasure, Kai.
The levees have held so far, and for what they cost, They should. The Army Corps of Engineers rebuilt the New Orleans levees after Katrina to the tune of about $14 billion. So as you're watching all the rain and wind down there today, one does wonder whether New Orleans, or any city for that matter, is, and bear with me here, worth it. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
Okay, that's beyond a loaded question. When the levees got built after Hurricane Betsy in 1965, the federal, state, and local government pretty much signed a contract to protect New Orleans. That contract had not been fulfilled for decades when Katrina hit, because New Orleans had gone so long without a big storm.
In the absence of a disaster, there's not much of a political appetite to spend billions of dollars.
Robert Meyer teaches risk management at the Wharton School. He says when you compare the cost of levee repairs to the tens of billions in damage from levee failures or the loss of all the economic activity in New Orleans,
$14 billion in the long run is actually pretty cheap.
So, as we watch New Orleans levees seemingly hold up to Isaac, have we learned a collective lesson about cost, benefit, and risk? Not if you're David Gutierrez. He's chief of safety for dams in California. And right now, he needs money to prevent disaster.
Billions and billions of dollars to fix the levees here in the Central Valley of California.
At least $14 billion, he says, to protect a huge chunk of the state from seasonal flooding. So far, he's got a fraction of that amount.
Trying to convince the public, the federal government or the state government that we should take action is absolutely something that we're always struggling with.
California's been denied federal funding to fix levees, even though those levees protect 500,000 people and $47 billion in property. There's just not the will to spend all that money to prevent something that hasn't happened yet. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
A little down, then a little up on Wall Street this Wednesday. Then, yeah, another flat finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Congressman Paul Ryan is the feature attraction at the Republican National Convention tonight down in Tampa Bay. It's his acceptance of the vice presidential nomination, of course. And the optics, as the pundits like to say, are going to be tricky. How to capitalize politically while Isaac is stuck over New Orleans. But once that's taken care of, it's a safe bet the speech is going to be reliably economic. Medicare, the budget, and what voters and this economy will get from a Romney administration. Just east of Tampa, the corridor along Interstate 4. Voters want recovery. They want the economy the way it used to be. Marketplace's David Gura took a little road trip along I-4 not too long ago. And today, in the second of two stories for our coverage of what really matters in this election, the real economy, we're calling it, the town of Port Orange, Florida, and a lesson in being careful what you wish for.
Perhaps no one knows the story of Port Orange better than Alan Green. He's lived in the city just south of Daytona Beach for all of his 73 years. And for many of them, he's been the city's mayor. A few feet from the banks of the Halifax River, Green remembers the Port Orange of his youth. There was a cluster of buildings here, and many of them were oyster houses.
Oysters were everything. They built roadways out of them. There was a lot of scrimpers. There were fishermen. They were that type of people. They were just working class people.
Today, the population of Port Orange is 50 times bigger than it was when Green was a kid. In many ways, it's emblematic of small cities across Florida that embraced growth and development over the last decade. In the case of Port Orange, much of its growth happened after a string of hurricanes hit the region in 2004 and 2005.
What were things like around here then? I mean, how dramatic?
Before the rockets started falling, everybody got greedy. They really did. After the hurricanes, you had that insurance money flowing, you had the economy flowing, and they bought land, overpriced land, condominiums, everybody had multiple homes.
Mayor Green is fit with a deep tan and a strong preference for shorts over suits. He keeps an office at City Hall, but it's pretty empty. He likes to be out and about conducting the city's business in person. Over the years, Green has been a proponent of growth, and when developers turned their attention to new subdivisions west of town, Green became the public face of a $500 million effort to redevelop the city's waterfront. He dreamed up a mix of condos, shops, and restaurants on the Halifax called the Port Orange Riverwalk.
Just look at the view. Look at that river. Tell me that's not a great view with the sun coming up in the morning.
But today, the Riverwalk is still a dream. Not a single high-rise has been built. After the housing collapse, land prices plummeted, developers pulled back, Riverwalk was shelved. In Florida, something that has been a selling point for the state has hurt places like Port Orange. Ken Small is with the Florida League of Cities.
We're one of very few states in the country that does not have an income tax.
That means cities and counties pay their bills with taxes they collect on property. Well, that worked well enough when home values were high, but since the housing bubble burst, municipalities have been struggling. Nearly half of all homeowners in this county owe more on their mortgages than their houses are worth.
And cities and counties have gone through tremendous budget cutting. And many of those cities still are showing their tax base is still shrinking.
Last year, Port Orange collected a third less money in taxes than it did 5 years earlier, $3.5 million less. City Hall is next to a pond with a fountain in the middle of a big park. This is another development Green oversaw. And he tells me that what's made the tax problem even worse are all the exemptions written into Florida law.
Nothing against veterans. They get veteran exemption.
There's also an exemption if your permanent residence is in Florida and if you're a senior. And in this community, a quarter of the population qualifies.
So if you do exemption, they're not paying their way.
Green estimates 35% of Port Orange pays no taxes to the city.
That's not right. That is not right. There is a cost associated with the quality of life, and you should pay your fair share of it.
Now, like other mayors in Florida, Green faces tough decisions: how to pay for city services, salaries for almost 400 full-time workers. Green says he always wanted to see Port Orange grow, but nowhere near as fast as it did. The town, he says, has lost its sense of community.
Big boxes are coming in. I'm not a big box fan.
The changes remind him of a song by country singer Alan Jackson called Little Man.
Now the court squares just a set of streets, and people go around, but they seldom think about the little man that built this town before the big money shut him down and killed the little man.
Green likes that song so much, he buys extra CDs to give away. He gave us a copy. Green's world isn't much bigger than 26 square miles. The only election he cares about this year already happened. Green just won a fifth term. The last presidential candidate he voted for was Ronald Reagan. He backed Ron Paul in the primaries, and he's not enthusiastic about either President Obama or Mitt Romney. In many ways, development has been the economy of Port Orange, and Green doesn't think either candidate can help the city find an alternative.
The only thing we export in Port Orange is dead bodies, and our kids have to go somewhere else to get a decent job.
Port Orange used to be known as the oyster capital of the world, and Mayor Green wants it to be known for something again. In Port Orange, Florida, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Lest you thought the traditional summertime wedding season is drawing to a close, Wall Street would like to disabuse you of that notion. The private equity firm Clayton, Dubilier & Rice has proposed to David's bridal. The deal values the wedding dress retailer just a hair over $1 billion. Urban Outfitters and Ann Taylor are getting into the wedding business as well. Sally Herships has more now on the sudden retail popularity of tying the knot.
I have a question for you. Ball gown or mermaid? Lace or satin? I'm talking about wedding dresses. Anya Winnicka is site director of TheKnot.com.
It's one of the most stared at, looked at pieces of clothing that a woman wears in her entire lifetime.
And then there are the pictures. Forever. But no pressure.
Americans historically have spent a lot of money on weddings.
Nancy Kane is a retail historian at Harvard.
The average wedding costs $27,000.
And the average bride spends $1,100 on her dress. Kane says even though an awful lot of Americans get divorced, we still love getting married. But the wedding industry has not exactly been in a honeymoon period lately.
No, the industry is definitely not recession-proof.
Shane McMurray is CEO of The Wedding Report. He says when the recession hit, people cut way back on weddings. But Anya Winnicka says within the bridal industry, fashion is worth $4 billion. In the wedding business, the trusted life partner is the dress.
If they're going down to the courthouse or to the JP or whatever, it doesn't matter. Even if they go down to some shop at the mall or something and it's not necessarily a full-blown wedding dress, they're going to buy a dress.
How romantic. That's why so many retailers are lining their racks with white. And don't forget dresses for the bridesmaids. Do you have anything in seafoam or guava? In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they think it's all a bowl of cherries. All they want to do is drive the ice cream truck. They think, oh, we can run around ringing bells, selling ice cream, eating ice cream, make it $1 million.
What it really takes to make it as an ice cream guy. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, we're playing the happy music, but really, it's a technicality. The Dow Industrials managed to add just 4 points today. That's barely a sliver of 1%, closed at 13,107, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ also bumped up 4 points, a little more than a tenth of 1%, came to rest at 3,081. The S&P 500 tacked on just 1 point flat, for all intents and purposes. The close there, 1,410. Today brought the end of the lockup period for insiders to start selling up to 52 million shares of Yelp, the online review site. Usually means a drop in value, but this time Yelp got some help. The stock actually jumped more than 22% today. Still down, though, by nearly 10% from its IPO price. The resignation of WellPoint's chief executive officer brought some relief for investors. The healthcare giant shares added more than 7% today. Bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged up to 1.65%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for July. Are folks window shopping or shopping? Chain stores release retail sales for August. And the Republican National Convention wraps in Tampa, Florida. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hey, so you remember the European debt crisis? Yeah, I didn't think you did. There has been something of a summertime lull over there. Sad to say, though, vacation's almost over, and as Marketplace's Stephen Beard is about to tell us, any hope the crisis dissipated while we weren't paying attention is sadly misplaced.
At least they had a carefree August on the beach. Eurozone leaders could relax. Markets were becalmed. Reassuringly, the European Central Bank was working on a plan to stop that nasty debt crisis. But, says fund manager Julian Pendock, the lazy, hazy days of summer are coming to an end.
Traditionally, September and October are always very bumpy months. I think quite a few people are getting a little bit nervous.
And specifically about that plan, which seems so reassuring on the beach. The European Central Bank wants to wade into the market and buy vast quantities of Spanish and Italian government bonds. But there's a cloud on the horizon. The German central bank, the Bundesbank, is vehemently opposed. And that, says Frankfurt-based analyst Stefan Schneider, probably means that most Germans will oppose it too.
Many people in Germany believe in God, but all of the Germans believe in the Bundesbank. So one shouldn't underestimate the power the Bundesbank has in shaping the German public opinion.
So when the European Central Bank unveils its plan next week, it may well be without full German support. Sony Kapoor of the Redefine think tank says don't expect a convincing raft of euro-saving measures.
These would not be enough by any stretch of imagination to stem the euro crisis once and for all. I'm afraid we are stuck with the euro crisis in the news for the foreseeable future.
In other words, he says, the summer will be over and the debt crisis will draw in and darken the markets again. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
London threw another big sports-related party today, the opening ceremony for the 2012 Paralympic Games. Athletes with a wide range of disabilities compete in everything from track and field and cycling to table tennis and judo. Miles Porter is on the American judo team. He's 27 years old, legally blind. He says he can see shapes from about 10 yards away. That's about it. Miles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I definitely appreciate it.
So how does judo work when you're visually impaired? There must be some challenges.
Yeah, there definitely is. I fight on the sighted side of judo as well as the Paralympic side. And the good thing about judo is the only adaption is you start with the grip, and if you break, the referees just lock you back up again and you start the match.
Aha. So it's not something coming out of the blue that's going to kick you in the ribs.
No, not too much. And the good thing is with judo, it's like the Japanese version of wrestling. So we do all the throws. So we're really pretty much always touching.
Does it feel a little bit like the Paralympics are a bit forgotten sometimes?
Sometimes I think because a lot of people don't realize, or they classify it maybe closer to a Special Olympics.
Yeah.
Because that's well branded in the U.S.
Does that take away the opportunities you might have after your career, after the games, to get endorsement deals and sort of capitalize in that way?
The Paralympics is still the second biggest sporting event in the world behind the Olympics. Even the World Cup of Soccer is still smaller than the Paralympics, which is kind of cool if you think about how big that is.
Yeah, that's crazy. I didn't know that.
Coca-Cola's picked up on Paralympics his last 4 years. BP has more Paralympic athletes in their sponsorship deals than they do Olympic athletes. United has a few. So if you take those are huge companies that has Paralympic athletes as a face of their corporations.
Hmm. This is a little bit materialistic, but do you guys talk about this, you the athletes?
Not so much, because we're just so grateful we're here.
Yeah.
I remember in 2007, I was having a bad day. I was complaining. I was young. I didn't want to train, this and that. And our coach threw us in the pool just to give us some different kind of workout. And I'm 225 pounds. I swim like a rock. So I'm struggling. Here's a guy that comes in with no arms and no legs and lapped me 3 times. I didn't complain the whole rest of that trip.
You said you fight on the sighted side of judo as well?
Yeah, I do able-bodied judo as well, yes, sir.
And you're not at a disadvantage?
I am. Being blind is a big disadvantage.
You know what this makes me think of is Oscar Pistorius, right? The South African runner who has artificial
legs. Yes, sir. A good friend of mine.
Oh, is that right? You know Oscar?
Yeah, I know him very well. I've known him since 2008.
Now, how is it that he gets to do able-bodied Olympics, but you don't?
I do. There's 99% of my tournaments are against able-bodied athletes. Right now, I'm ranked number 2 in the country behind the guy that actually made the regular Olympic teams. Hopefully, if I keep the points, I'll be going to the World Championships. I'll be the first visually impaired person in the world in the history of judo to go.
What's your competition schedule? When's your first match?
With judo, we fight everything in one day. My weight class. I fight on September 1st. We weigh in at 6 in the morning. Tournament starts at 11, and finals, hopefully I'm there, start at 4 o'clock. So I'll find out if I have a medal that day.
Go. That's crazy, man. 4 years into one day, like 18 hours.
Yes, sir.
Miles Porter, he is a legally blind Paralympian. He's a judo athlete. All right, man. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
In observance of the passing of summer that is soon to be upon us, a story now about one of the mainstays of this season, the neighborhood ice cream truck. Yes, it can be a little slice of heaven on a 97-degree day, but while you're thinking about chocolate eclairs or bomb pops, your ice cream truck driver, he's thinking about a complicated economic calculus. Lauren Chuljin reports now from WBEZ in Chicago.
Hello. Ice cream truck driver Johnny Max has been playing this song out of his antique ice cream truck through downtown Chicago since the 1970s. Max is a traditional ice cream guy through and through. He wears all white and even calls himself the Good Humor Man. But he says his job isn't as fun as some people think it is.
They think it's all a bowl of cherries. All they want to do is drive the ice cream truck. They think, oh, we can run around ringing bells, selling ice cream, eating ice cream, making $1 million, but that's really not the case.
Ice cream drivers like Max need to stock up on specific flavors for specific neighborhoods. Last year's route might not work this year because neighborhood kids may have gotten too old. And then there's the encroachment of the far more mobile ice cream pushcart. Max says there are no guarantees in this business. That's why day after day, summer after summer, he drives the same route.
Same old rigmarole, downtown in the loop, my spot at Canal and Monroe. Should have said that?
He shouldn't have said that because there are actually fights over territories.
There are people that go in the same areas. And if a newcomer goes into an established area established by somebody else, then they're going to get very mad, even maybe hostile, you never know.
Some drivers are really aggressive,
and some of them aggressive, but in the professional way, and they protect the route.
That's Alex Sadeghi, co-owner of Pars Ice Cream on Chicago's West Side. He's the one supplying drivers like Max with ice cream, helping them get licenses, and leasing out trucks. He's sort of like the ice cream godfather. When there's a fight between drivers, he steps in.
You bring them in, you talk to both of them, explain to them that end of the day, they're in the same ball. And we need to help each other and to help the industry. Fighting each other is not going to help at all.
Sadeghi says he brings the drivers to a map in the back to remind them how large the city is and how many people there are to sell ice cream to. Of course, it's not that easy. It's Chicago, and there are rules. In fact, there are a lot of rules. For the last 20 years, ice cream trucks have been restricted in some of the city's 50 wards. And in some of those wards, the rules go street by street. I was going to read them to show how detailed they are, but they're best heard in a good Chicago accent. So I recruited my colleague, Chicago native Jason Mark. Fair warning, he may have hammed it up a little bit.
Thence east on West Pope John Paul II Drive to Southwestern Boulevard, thence north on Southwestern Boulevard to West 34th Street, thence east.
And this summer, even more rules went into place. The city council passed a food truck ordinance that also covers ice cream trucks. Now ice cream drivers have to install GPS devices, trucks can't park near restaurants, and they can't sell treats too close to official truck stands. The city contends that the new ordinance actually gives all mobile food vendors more parking options, but all of this has some drivers wondering if it's worth all the hassle for next year. For now, though, you can still get your
strawberry shortcake, chocolate eclair, giant banana sandwich, king cone.
But only until the weather gets cold.
They love that SpongeBob, Spider-Man.
In Chicago, I'm Lauren Chulgen for Marketplace.
Lauren's reporting on the rough and tumble world of ice cream trucks first aired on WBEZ out of Chicago.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a sly bit of Democratic politicking as the GOP meets down in Tampa Bay. President Obama was on the website Reddit today doing a regular feature of theirs. It's called Ask Me Anything. And I'll tell you, people really did, serious and not. Here's one. In what ways will you attempt to make university a more affordable path for students? Fair enough. Do you enjoy a good piece of bacon on everything? Was another one. What is your least favorite state in the USA? I don't think he answered that one. Here's my personal favorite. Will you release the White House beer that has been brewed during your administration for public consumption? President did say the recipe for that beer would be out soon, is the word he used. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. Today, the Dow up 4 points, just a sliver of 1%. The Nasdaq likewise added 4 points, a little more than a tenth of a percent. The S&P 500 tacked on a single point, not quite a tenth of 1%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.